Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, if you're being slammed with higher electric bills this summer, you're not alone. Why have the rates gone up so dramatically, and what can be done about it? We'll hear more. It's not just your power bill squeezing the budget. Homeowners insurance is rising. A consumer advocate talks to us about it. If you want to take advantage of government help for green energy purchases, you'll need to act fast. Colleges and universities are under a lot of pressure with enrollment challenges and more people questioning the value of spending on higher education. One private college is making big changes. We'll have a report. A plan to increase the availability of public defenders is awaiting action. More on what it would do. And Pope Leo grew up in the Chicago suburbs. His home is becoming a tourist destination. Those stories and more this hour on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Ahead, we'll talk electric rates, which have skyrocketed for some this summer. But first, Pope Leo XIV's childhood home in suburban Dalton has become a tourist attraction. Adora Numugude has more from the Pope's hometown.
An 8-hour Gregorian chant YouTube playlist streams out Dania Sanye Davis's windows and plays softly in the yard. There's a fold-up table with free bottled water and soda for visitors.
Food always brings people together. Drinking, the outreaches that I've been a part of, they always had food. It was always something free, and we talked and we hung out at church.
That is the atmosphere Davis is aiming to replicate in this corner of the South Side. She lives next door to the Pope's childhood home. Davis says everyday people are taking pictures and praying in front of the modest brick house. Some people come in hopes that touching the Pope's childhood home will offer healing of physical ailments.
People touch the house to get healed. They take rocks home and the leaves off the tree. I mean, they're really, really into this big time. Even my husband took a rock and he put it in his pocket, said it's a holy sacred rock.
A fitting symbol since Catholics regard Pope Leo as the rock of the church. Luis Guano Luisa stopped by with his friend on a gray weekday morning. They were visiting from Ecuador.
Yo siento paz.
He's saying being at the Pope's house makes him feel like he is with the Pope, and that closeness draws him closer to Jesus. The simple three-bedroom home is 1,050 square feet and features minimal stone landscaping. The door is bright red, and there are a couple Our Lady of Guadalupe pillar candles on the front concrete steps. There's a sign on the front lawn marking 212 East 141st Place as the Pope's childhood home. The village of Dalton put up the sign after purchasing the house for $375,000, almost 30% more than the asking price. The neighborhood's fallen on hard times since the Pope's family sold the house in 1996. There used to be a couple of large steel mills here, but the decline of the U.S. manufacturing economy and white flight have left behind a village where some residents don't feel their basic needs are being met. Down the street, resident Giovanni Murphy says she's happy the village bought the property. She's lived on this block for 10 years. She says that, with recent political shifts, the town's future was improving.
So people were getting ready for a great shift, and we were already going towards a positive, and the Pope just sealed the deal.
Mayor Jason House, who took office a few months ago, told constituents that purchasing Pope Leo's childhood home was an investment in the town's future.
This is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. We can either seize this moment and move it forward, or we can let that moment go to an investor.
Mayor House said the town plans to renovate the Pope's childhood home and open it to the public. Neighbor Elaine Wheatley hopes the village turning the house into a historic landmark will inspire kids in the neighborhood to dream big.
And I believe that house there, when children are walking by that house with that sign there that says, look at what he did. If he can do it, so can I.
She says if anyone should own the house, it should be the people of Dalton. For NPR News, I'm Adora Namigadde in Dalton, Illinois.
Colleges and universities are facing the combined pressures of shifting student demographics, declining enrollment, and some skepticism about the value of higher education. Against that backdrop, a private liberal arts college in Western Illinois is phasing out 10 majors and enhancing other programs based on student interest and market demand. Jane Carlson has the story.
It's quiet on the Monmouth College campus in early August, except for the occasional buzzing of a lawnmower or birdsong ringing from towering oaks on the front lawn of Wallace Hall. Soon, there will be other sounds at the home of the Fighting Scots. Bagpipes, football practice, and students moving into their residence halls. This year's incoming class will have around 40 more students than last year's, with a couple dozen of them coming to Monmouth for a brand new nursing program in collaboration with OSF Healthcare. Monmouth President Patricia Draves says the college would like to see enrollment reach the high 800s in the next 3 or 4 years, with slow, controlled growth of an additional 50 students per year.
And we're trying to be realistic too, right? Because it's easy to put a number on a spreadsheet and say, okay, we can do this, but in a declining demographic, what's realistic?
Draves is a cancer researcher who taught chemistry at Monmouth in the early 2000s, when enrollment was on an uphill climb, reaching a high of nearly 1,400 students in 2009. More recently, enrollment has been in the low 700s. Draves says in addition to fewer students going to college, their needs and interests have changed. She says millennials wanted new dorms and climbing walls and fancy food in the cafeteria. But current students grew up in the aftermath of the 2008 recession. They are pragmatic, socially conscious, and they don't want to go in debt.
The Gen Zers care about relationships. Mm-hmm. They ask about the support. They're aware they need, you know, mental health services and development. And so they're asking for more of those pieces and an environment that offers that.
Draves became Monmouth College's 15th president last year. She was tasked by the Board of Trustees this year to undertake an academic prioritization process to assess and prioritize academic programs in order to strategically allocate resources. Draves says in the early 2000s, it was about doing more with more. And when 2008 hit, it was about doing more with less.
And now we're really entering the let's do less with less. But let's focus on what we're good at, what we can do really well moving forward, and then people want.
The college's academic prioritization task force included faculty from different disciplines, along with administrators. It also included Board of Trustee members, though they were non-voting members. The task force first created guiding principles for their work, then gathered data and investigated three main areas. One is program quality, based on everything from external reviews, department narratives, and student evaluations. The other areas they studied are economic sustainability and demand. Mark Wilhart is Dean of the Faculty and Vice President for Academic Affairs.
You know, what's the demand? Are students interested? How do we know? You know, looking at admissions funnels. Then there was an economics group that was looking at per course, per program.
After months of data analysis and difficult discussions, the task force delivered its recommendations. A number of programs, including business, marketing, data science, nursing, exercise science, and elementary education, are in the grow and invest category. Others, like accounting, English, math, physics, music, and theater, are in the maintain category, though they will undergo some changes. And 10 low-demand majors, primarily in the humanities and social sciences, are being phased out. Majors like history, anthropology, religious studies, environmental studies, and Spanish. Plus, 6 faculty positions in those disciplines are being phased out, too. Wilhart says these low-demand programs at Monmouth reflect national trends.
We have seen the humanities dwindle, not because we haven't had talented people in some good programs, but because students are just less interested in pursuing them when they come in. Even if our faculty are good at talking about jobs thereafter, they just don't see them.
But a liberal arts college without a history major? A Presbyterian college without a religious studies major? Wilhart says there's no set list of majors you need to be a liberal arts college.
We are still going to offer history courses. We are still going to offer philosophy courses and religious study courses. Mm-hmm. They are still going to be part of what we do. And I think that's a misconception. People think that we've eliminated the program, and so we're just going to stop teaching those. That's not true.
The majors being phased out represent 7% of current and incoming students. And those students will be able to finish their degrees at Monmouth. Meanwhile, fields like data science, computer science, and human services are emerging as areas of potential growth at Monmouth. Another part of the restructuring is the development of 6 schools housing the remaining programs. President Draves says the new academic structure reflects a commitment to liberal arts education.
It's really about the breadth, exposure to different disciplines, different methodology, different ways of thinking, and then some critical, durable skills moving forward.
Draves insists the process was not to cut a predetermined amount of money from the budget, and it wasn't because the college is in danger of closing. but it was to align expenses and revenue and to ensure the college's long-term health. The administration says Monmouth has a healthy endowment of over $140 million and relatively low debt compared to other institutions. Will Hart has been meeting with departments this summer to talk about the changes. He says enrollment growth goals used to be something that the president set, and then it was the work of the admissions office. But that's increasingly seen as a role of the faculty at Monmouth.
This is an expectation for you. We would like to see you bring in X number of students because we think that the real recruiting power on the academic side is there, that the counselors in admissions are doing a really, really good job, but that often the faculty are the ones who can help really seal that deal.
After the initial prioritization process, Monmouth is establishing an ongoing 2-year evaluation cycle to review academic programs and potentially add new ones. TSPR asked the college's Faculty Senate for comment on the academic restructuring, but did not receive one. I'm Jane Carlson.
This summer has been hot and costly for many electric customers. Some have seen their monthly bills more than double, and it's putting a strain on finances. We hear about the impact in this report from Ryan Denham in Normal.
There's never a good time for your electric bill to suddenly go up nearly $1,000, but this was an especially bad time for Stephen Marfurin and his two Windy City Wieners locations.
It's just annoying, you know, it really is.
He says business slows down in the summer. The ISU crowd thins out in Uptown Normal, and many people go on vacation, even judges and lawyers, which means less foot traffic at his downtown Bloomington store. Then, last month, Marfurin's electric bill shot up 35% without much change in energy use.
It kind of hurts when it comes in your slower times, but now your overhead's getting, you know, kind of out of whack a little bit.
Central Illinois homeowners, renters, and business owners like Marfurin are grappling with sharply increased electricity costs this summer. Ameren Illinois says it's a power supply problem. Too much demand for too little supply, leading to a 20-fold increase in summer capacity prices. It wasn't a surprise. Ameren and others warned us this was coming. Still, doesn't make it easy. Like many others, Windy City Wieners has tried to adapt. They keep the thermostat at 75 degrees during the day and crank it to 77 overnight. Marfurin says he's delaying equipment upgrades, like a brand new air fryer he hasn't hooked up yet. But he doesn't have that many levers to pull. It would take a lot of $4 hot dogs to make up for the nearly $1,000 in increased cost. So how is he going to make that math?
Just pay myself less. I mean, there's really nothing else I'm going to do, you know? It's not like I'm going to adjust anything. You know, you know it's coming, and you hope it's not as bad as it's been.
Marfurin was one of 24 Central Illinoisans who responded to WGLT's call-out for stories about those impacted by rising electric bills. Another was Cody Kretzinger, who rents an apartment in Bloomington. He says his June bill jumped to $492, up from $225 in May and $268 this time a year ago.
So this is the first time that a utility bill has actually shocked me when I opened it up. Sure, every other month, you know, there might be some increases here or there, some more utilization, something along those lines. But for it to double and then some was the first time where I actually kind of had to sit back and think, how did the bill go up quite so much?
Kretzinger has seen other cost of living increases too, like groceries, gas prices, and other household utilities. Kretzinger says he's grateful he can budget for these increases, but he's aware that many others cannot. Kretzinger is an Ameren customer, and Ameren says it's not their fault, that they're just passing along rising supply costs coming off the grid. Here's company chairman and president Lenny Singh during a recent stop in Peoria.
We understand what customers are facing, and we're just as frustrated as customers around the energy prices and the volatility we see. Again, Ameren does not generate power. We procure it on the market through the Illinois Power. The state procures it through the Illinois Power Agency, and we pass it on to customer at no markup.
Cody Kretzinger says he thinks Ameren is making a disingenuous argument about the cost.
They're not just a passive delivery service. They are, in fact, a $27 billion company who we both know they're not struggling. And they're trying to hide behind the excuse of the rate increases. And you know, kind of passing the blame. It feels like they're more focused on lining their own pockets and their shareholders instead of really kind of helping their customers.
Kretzinger says they're trying to hide behind this notion of, quote, just being a delivery company.
I hope that there's enough outrage out of all of this that they'll maybe change their ways.
Customers are already changing their ways. Aaron Keist lives in Pontiac with his wife and 10-year-old son. They're ComEd customers. He says their bill last month was $545, up from $238 a year ago.
You know, it's outrageous if you ask me. I don't see how this is going to work for me to even survive. I'm going to have to get a second job to pay my electric bill.
Their house is big, but updated for high efficiency, including a smart thermostat that they've already cranked up a bit. Keist says they're going to start drying their clothes outside to cut down on running the dryer. Keist works as a CNC machinist, and his employer just told him there wouldn't be any overtime for a while. So he's picking up some side work as a mechanic to avoid cutting into the family's savings. His wife works part-time as a beautician.
This may force her to be full-time, and then it's going to cost me even more because I'm going to have to get, you know, daycare for my son.
And Keist sees some irony because at work he makes parts that ultimately get used by the energy industry.
So I'm like, in the back of my head, I'm like, I'm doing all this stuff for the energy, and I can't even get a break on my electric bill.
The end of July heat wave we saw certainly didn't help either. Nick McBurney is a homeowner in Normal. He says that summer heat made it dangerous to go outside and expensive to be inside, and it's eating into his strained budget.
It was 22% more than it was last year, like $50-something dollars, and it was the same, almost exactly the same amount of electricity.
Higher electricity prices paired with food costs and mortgage and insurance increases have left McBurney keeping a close eye on the household budget.
Oh, yeah, we've definitely taken to going to food pantries.
And they've cut back on doing anything outside the house.
To make up for some of the money going out to all the necessary bills.
McBurney says he thinks Ameren as an electricity delivery provider is not to blame. Instead, it's on the energy producers themselves, such as Meta signing a 20-year agreement for over a gigawatt of electricity from the Clinton nuclear power plant.
The way that the system is set up for sourcing of electricity, it seems to be that more every year the electricity is going out to places that are not houses. They just signed that whole thing to keep the Clinton nuclear power plant running just to keep the AI going. And it's just, but that's not actually improving our prices at all.
Some relief is on the way. For Ameren customers, the company says the higher electric supply price is expected to only be in effect until September, with a return to more normal levels starting October 1st. Reporting with Vivi Hughes, I'm Ryan Denham.
Next, we'll talk with a consumer advocate about the rise in insurance rates. Stay with us for more of Statewide. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. A consumer advocate is calling on state lawmakers to adopt new regulations against the insurance industry. This after State Farm adopted 27% rate hikes on some homeowner policies. Abe Scar is director of the Illinois Public Interest Research Group. And in a conversation with Vivi Hughes, Scar says State Farm and other insurers need more oversight to prevent miscalculations that lead to more homeowners paying much higher premiums.
If you look at what State Farm says in its rate filing, is that this is based on its expected future catastrophe losses. So this is about predicting the future, which is, of course, hard to do. And, you know, they're a very sophisticated company. I'm sure they have good ways of trying to make reasonable assumptions and predict the impact of extreme weather on future losses. But they are making predictions. They are making assumptions. They are using data to predict what will happen in the future. And there's no reason to believe that they're doing that perfectly. In fact, as they point out, they've, you know, been paying out more losses than they've been taking in. They haven't gotten it right in the past. So why should we believe that they're going to get it right this time? And why should we not have some public authority like the Illinois Department of Insurance have the ability to review their assumptions, review their models for predicting the future, and see if it's reasonable? And maybe instead of a half a billion dollar rate hike, we will see only a $250 million rate hike, which would still be massive, but not quite as massive and not hit Illinois policyholders as hard.
Could you describe PIRG's reaction to J.B. Pritzker's critical statement regarding the spikes?
We were very pleased to see it. Until recently, Illinois did not have rate review for any type of insurance, this basic consumer protection where insurance regulators can review rate increases and determine whether they are excessive and modify them if so. Again, we don't have that for property or car insurance. And until recently, we didn't have it for health insurance either. But over several years, 2023 and 2024, the Illinois General Assembly, at the urging of Governor Pritzker, did adopt these basic rate review policies for health insurance. And they did so in a bipartisan fashion. Governor Pritzker's Department of Insurance this spring introduced legislation to create a rate review process for home and auto insurance, and we supported that. We were pleased to see that. So we take his statement to say that this is now a priority for him in the governor's office. And so we're very pleased about that. He said that he wants to see it done during veto session this October, which will not be easy given the power of the insurance industry in the General Assembly.
Can you describe how these increases will impact low-income, middle-income, and high-income homeowners?
As you can imagine, lower-income folks who may have paid off their house and paid off their mortgage, but still have to make property tax payments and insurance payments, those are the folks who are going to struggle more with a rate increase like this. And it may also make it harder for new home buyers to buy a home. So there's not a state mandate to have homeowners insurance like there is for auto. If you're going to drive a car, you're required to buy some minimum protections, but lenders enforce it effectively. So effectively, if you're going to get a mortgage to buy a house, which almost everybody needs to do it, but especially, lower and moderate income folks, you're going to have to get homeowners insurance. So these increases, not only for State Farm, but across the board in the homeowners insurance industry, are going to make homeownership further away for folks if they cannot afford not only their mortgage payment, but property taxes and insurance on top.
The insurance industry says allowing regulators to reject rate increases could become overly burdensome, and it could actually run the risk of leading some insurers to take their business out of Illinois entirely. What do you think of this concern?
I think it's overblown. Again, this type of basic consumer protection exists in almost every other state. And last time I checked, insurers do business in almost every other state. Certainly, there could be a time and place where state regulation is overly burdensome and does impact the willingness of businesses to do business in the state. But there's nothing at that level on the table. And basically what you're hearing is hyperbole from the industry, acting as if Governor Pritzker or the Department of Insurance wants to place onerous regulation on the industry, when really what they're proposing is basic fundamental consumer protections which exist in almost every other state in the country. So I just don't put much credit into that line of argument. And I don't think the General Assembly or the public should either.
How do you see these rate spikes affecting not just State Farm, but the broader insurance industry as well?
Well, the industry has been raising homeowners rates aggressively. Again, in the last 3 years, homeowners insurance rates in Illinois have increased by 50%, more than any other state but one in the country. And the industry is doing quite well, despite all of their doom and gloom rhetoric about increasing losses and the challenges of extreme weather. Last year, numbers just came out that the property and casualty insurance industry made $167 billion in profit in 2024. That was a 91% increase over the previous year, almost doubling their profits. Now, it's important to note that State Farm is a mutual insurance company, so they don't have private investors and they don't have profits in the same manner. But they're a giant in the industry, and that profit figure is indicative of the health of the industry, which is doing quite well. So I think we should take their language and their talk about the rise of extreme weather with a grain of salt.
Abe Scar with the Illinois Public Interest Research Group, and he spoke with Vivi Hughes. Governor Pritzker has suggested State Farm is shifting out-of-state costs onto homeowners in Illinois to offset the cost of disasters in other states. State Farm has denied that. Green energy tech like efficient heat pumps or water heaters can reduce climate pollution and also bring down your electric bill. But if you want the federal government to help pay for those upgrades, you better move fast. Julia Simon has details.
Let's say you want home solar or an electric vehicle. There have been federal tax credits to make them a whole lot cheaper. On July 4th, President Trump signed what he calls the One Big Beautiful Bill. White House spokesperson Taylor Rogers says it will unleash American energy, but the law eliminates these federal tax credits that make homes more energy efficient, and soon.
We've got a limited time offer dynamic.
This is Ari Matusiak, CEO of the nonprofit Rewiring America.
For most of these credits, it means if you want to access them, then really you need to get going on the relevant improvement before the end of the year.
Let's start with the tax credit for home solar, also solar water heaters and geothermal heat pumps. Here's Sean Gallagher at the Solar Energy Industries Association.
If you're a homeowner and you want to install solar on your roof, there's been a 30% tax credit for residential solar projects.
That tax credit disappears December 31st. Here's Matusiak again.
But that basically means that people should sign a contract with a contractor before the end of the calendar year.
And to be safe, make sure the panels are also paid for and installed before the end of the year. There's also, for now, another tax credit for eligible heat pumps and water heaters, plus home upgrades like new insulation. But these tax credits also go away at the end of the year. As for electric vehicles,
if you're in the market for a new car and that new car happens to be an EV, you should probably go get one before September 30th.
Joseph Yoon is a consumer analyst with Edmunds. Currently, EV buyers are eligible for a federal tax credit worth up to $7,500 for buying or leasing a new EV and thousands for a used EV. That's all being eliminated at the end of September. You might be able to get money from your state, local government, or utility for things like water heaters and heat pumps. But because a lot of states' money for rebates also came from Biden-era policies, experts suggest checking on them sooner rather than later. Julia Simon, NPR News.
NPR's Camila Domonoske contributed reporting.
Drought is defined as an abnormal period of dryness, but climate change means today's normal might not be the same as yesterday's. The National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine are now working on a new framework that factors climate trends into how we think about drought. The Ag and Water Desk's Harshan Radhapal has more on why that's so tricky.
Missouri State climatologist Zach Leeser works in an office divided by time. On the right is the old way of doing things. Dozens of scratched and torn, leather-bound books filled with more than 100 years of handwritten state and local climate data. Cracking one open, Leeser turns to July 15, 1936, when the city of Columbia saw a high of 111 degrees.
This was the second hottest day on record ever in Columbia at that time in 1936.
A climatologist in the early 1900s would have spent each day collecting data with weather instruments and recording them in these books. But today, Leeser spends much more time on the left side of his office, where his computer is displaying weather models. One of his primary jobs is interpreting vast amounts of data every week to determine which parts of the state are in drought.
It can be precipitation data, we add soil moisture data, we have stream flow that's analyzed, some satellite data as well.
The job of a climatologist has changed a lot in 100 years. The climate has too. And those changes are making it harder to tell what is or isn't a drought. That's because drought is a measure of dryness relative to a, quote, normal baseline. But what if climate change is changing what's considered normal?
Is it really a drought, or is this just the new climate of this region?
That's climatologist Joel Lisenby. He does drought research out of the University of Colorado Boulder and is trying to answer that question. And he says it's a bit situational. There's no one answer to what drought even is. A 1985 study found over 150 published definitions of the term.
You really need to understand what type of drought you're looking at and why you're asking that question in the first place.
For instance, a climatologist whose job it is to take the long view of weather and climate might look at how dry things were over 100 years ago to determine if a place is in drought. If conditions are consistently getting hotter and drier, as they are in the American Southwest, maybe drought isn't the best way to define it. Here's Leeser.
Now, is this drought, or what we call aridification, which is the entire climate getting drier?
That might mean cities develop land and water use plans that account for those changes. But a farmer will define drought more immediately. If things are dry and crops aren't growing, it's a drought. Climatologists are now coming together to figure out how to characterize drought because their proclamations have real practical consequences. For example, one of the tools used to assess drought is the U.S. Drought Monitor. It's updated weekly to track dry conditions and their severity across the country. Some federal policies that give farmers emergency relief money are tied to the Drought Monitor. If it's not calibrated to the new normals caused by climate change, that money might not be going to the right places. Here's Lisenby again.
We're talking real dollars, taxpayer dollars, and we really want to make sure that we're getting that assessment correct.
Understanding new weather and drought patterns is also important for planning ahead.
Building a reservoir or a pipeline or locks along a river, are you going to have enough water during the dry years? If that normal is lowering, is the drought period also lowering with it? These are some unknowns.
Back in his office, Leeser puts the 1936 climate record back on the shelf. He says Missouri doesn't really get to those scorching temperatures anymore. But the state is prone to drought, and its average temperature is trending upward. He'll be watching the National Academy study for how to incorporate that into his drought assessments. I'm Harshan Ratanpal.
At 82 years old, Eugene Usher doesn't need a slot at the farmer's market. His red pickup truck just off the highway in Rantoul has become a local favorite for fresh collard greens and watermelons. Patricia Bradford brings us his story.
Eugene Usher is 82 years old. He's the youngest of 14 children raised in a sharecropping family in Conyers, Georgia. Usher also served in Vietnam. For nearly 2 years, he cooked meals for his fellow Army soldiers.
I cooked on base. I cooked in the Army. No, and that's a big part of me. I had 6 people over my house the other day, last Sunday.
And you cooked for everybody?
Yeah.
Yeah. On most days, you'll find Usher selling collard greens and watermelons near the Dairy Queen. The Collard Green Company is stamped in bold white letters on both sides of his truck. He sits next to it under a worn blue tent shielded from the summer sun.
Yes, sir.
How much for the watermelon?
They're $15.
15?
Yes, sir.
Grab one of them.
Two of them.
The watermelons come from Missouri. He makes a 600-mile round trip about 3 to 4 times during July and August to pick up the largest melons he can find. He grows the collard greens in a few plots behind his Rantoul home.
And I started picking the greens at 6 this morning. You know, I finally got 20 buckets that we was picking and came over here about going on 8 o'clock. Took us that long. But normally I would have somebody help me set up. And once I get set up, you know, I'm good.
The summer heat hasn't stopped him. Even on the 4th of July, Usher was out there, sweat on his brow, ready for anyone who stopped by.
Can I get that one right there?
You sure can.
Okay, $15, right?
15.
Let's make sure you get a 5.
On the weekends, he'll sometimes park his truck near the Savoy 16 movie theater.
You never thought about going to the farmer's market?
I did, I do, I would, and I have.
Oh, okay.
So
okay.
This is my best bet, like I'm doing.
But this isn't just about selling food. It's a way for him to stay connected and keep going. His wife passed away 7 years ago, and his son died in April.
I've seen my wife, family pass on. My family, all of them pass on. God's plan. It's for me to be here.
And so Eugene Usher keeps showing up, stacking his watermelons just right and saying hi to everyone that stops by.
I don't have no more heartache. All my have to be, gotta be, is gone. Now it's down to if I want to be. If I want to come out here and sit out here today, I didn't have to do this. I didn't have to go get nothing. And I thank God for bringing me this far, so I can say that.
This thing's heavy.
I know.
Thank you.
I'm Patricia Bradford, IPM News.
Just ahead, what happens when someone is transferred from a maximum security prison to a less restrictive environment? A new class at Danville Correctional Center aims to help. That story just ahead on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Illinois closed this century-old Stateville Correctional Center last year. Many of the men housed there went from being in a maximum security facility to less restrictive environments, and that transition can be overwhelming. Emily Hayes has more on what one facility is doing to help its new transfers adjust to surroundings.
There are parts of the medium-security Danville Correctional Center that don't look anything like the prisons you see in movies.
The sidewalks, and then there's grass in between, and they're kind of brick buildings on all the sides. And there's some flowers here, some daffodils, I guess.
This open green space could be a city plaza, but when you look a bit closer,
we have some wire that's kind of like barbed wire over stuff.
Danville had an infusion of new people following the closure of Stateville, including Alfred Moore Bay.
Doing time has, you know, it has a lot of pressure on you.
Moore Bay has been incarcerated for 27 years for abetting a murder. At first, prison officials brought him to another maximum security facility. Then he applied to move to Danville.
After you've been on the max level for so many years, where you're just in a cell on a thin gallery, every now and then you get a little movement, but here it's a lot more movement.
He says that can be hard to handle, especially when you spent years training to constantly be on high alert like he has. It's something corrections counselor Jason Baer noticed after the transfers began arriving.
Some of those guys are older, and the speed of the younger guys, it's almost an overstimulation. And they are very grumpy. They can be very grumpy about it.
Michael Abdul-Rauf Hearn understands these feelings. He's served 23 years so far for a murder charge. About a year and a half ago, he and others at Danville created a class to help the new influx from Stateville and other high-security prisons.
We've kind of piecemealed it.
Hearn looked at what the prison was already doing well, the peer education program called Building Block.
We've seen things that the building blocks have used, and we think those things were great, and we adapted it.
Their new three-month program includes units on critical thinking, communication, trauma, and life planning.
It may seem a little bit out of place for individuals in custody who are serving longer sentences or have been incarcerated for a longer amount of time than the average prisoner here within the institution, but we still feel it's important, and we've integrated it into our curriculum.
Hearn met Alfred Moore Bay when he moved into the long-term offender section of the prison. That's when he found out that Moore Bay had already taken higher education courses on restorative justice at Stateville, so he asked him to help out. Moore Bay teaches three communication skills classes a week, plus weekends and tutoring.
A lot of people, when they're making their transition, you know, they seem to be standoffish, don't want to say much, hold back things, you know, I'm tough, macho, but to break that wall is big. And when you're able to break that wall, you can start to see the wall come down, and now people become more who they are.
Hearn says they're currently in their last module with what he calls the long-term guys, who are often sentenced for life.
We'll be on the yard, or we'll be in obscure places where the commissary or what have you, and I hear somebody repeating to another person something that they learned. Because then it means they've internalized it. It's just not regurgitating it, but they've used it in a way that is appropriate and in a way that cements that they've actually understood it.
Corrections counselor Jason Baer oversees the program from the staff side, but says Moore Bay, Hearn, and the others do the heavy lifting. And in a short amount of time, they've already helped the younger and the older men get to know one another.
Those guys are awesome. They're like, hey, you know, hey, go meet them. See how they got the pep in their step.
Peer education in Illinois prisons started at the Danville Correctional Center, and its programs have shown enough success that staff from other facilities are replicating their model throughout the state. In the process of teaching others, Alfred Moore Bay says he's also learned more about himself.
I didn't think I was an effective communicator. And going through the program, it showed me that actually I'm pretty good at it, and it's natural.
While this summer's classes are wrapping up, the course will continue with new students. I'm Emily Hayes.
The first major change to Illinois' public defense system in decades is awaiting the governor's signature. The Funded Advocacy and Independent Representation, or FAIR Act, establishes a statewide office aimed at providing relief for chronically overworked, under-resourced public defenders. Colleen Holden has more.
Illinois instituted a system for court-appointed attorneys in 1949. A landmark 1963 U.S. Supreme Court case, Gideon v. Wainwright, established the right to counsel for indigent defendants in felony cases being tried in state courts. Illinois is one of just five states without a centralized statewide system for funding and administering public defense, leaving it almost entirely to the county.
The right to an attorney is not just the right to a warm body in court, but a meaningful defense.
That's Stephanie Coleman, policy director of the Children and Family Justice Center at Northwestern University, Pritzker School of Law. Coleman was part of a research team studying the state's public defense system county by county. Coleman says the constitutional right to counsel falls to the state.
And currently it's paying about $1 of every $10 spent on public defense. If all 10 of those dollars are really its legal duty to ensure that they're happening, it ought to be covering more of those dollars, and we need to focus on expanding the pool of resources available to defense.
The Northwestern research team found that no county in Illinois was fully staffed. The 11th Judicial Circuit, which includes McLean County, has less than half the attorneys needed to meet demand for public defense. And with no investigators, no social workers, and not enough paralegals and support staff, defendants are left hanging. Their attorneys barely able to keep up with their caseloads.
Right now, we are handling it, but we are treading water.
That's Elizabeth Pollock, Chief Public Defender for Champaign County. According to the Northwestern study, Champaign is short 16 attorneys and has one investigator. They need 10. Pollock prioritizes work-life balance for her staff, taking on each murder case herself, a move she admits is unsustainable long-term. She says it's not yet gotten to the point that they're turning away defendants.
So it could very easily get to the point that if there were so many cases that I'm looking at my people and thinking, I'm going to lose these people, then I would consider taking a step like that. We just haven't gotten there since I've been here.
In a statement, McLean County Public Defender Ron Lewis echoed Pollock, saying counties like theirs with established public defender offices, quote, anticipate operations remaining essentially the same. Lewis says the greatest benefit will be in the smaller counties, some of which don't have a full-time public defender. But there are signs of cracks in McLean County's system, with some defendants opting to navigate their cases pro se. Marcus Folks is one. He's currently detained in McLean County Jail, charged with armed robbery and fleeing police connected to a burglary at a fast food drive-thru in 2023. In a letter to WGLT, Folks says he was representing himself because, quote, public defenders do not like to help inmates. My last public defender told me that she was not going to fight for my identification against the state. So yes, I went pro se because she was out to railroad me in trial. At a hearing on August 5th, Judge William Yoder denied a motion Folks filed to have his case moved out of Judge Jason Chambers' courtroom. Yoder denied the motion and coached Folks when he attempted to preemptively object to the prosecution's statements. Champaign County Public Defender Elizabeth Pollock says it often comes down to a lack of capacity to build trust with the client.
You can file the most kick-ass motion to suppress in the world, but if your client isn't able to get a hold of you, that is the root of every problem.
Stephanie Coleman from Northwestern University says caseload and resources are only half the battle of a zealous defense.
The chief public defender in almost every county is appointed by the chief judge of the circuit. And so especially in smaller counties, what you can end up with is an attorney appointed by the very person that they're appearing in front of. And when that person, the judge, wants to move along their docket or has particular views and they naturally conflict, sometimes, you know, the judge's role is neutral arbiter and the attorney's role is zealous advocate for their clients. And sometimes those interests can conflict.
The goal of the pending FAIR Act is to bring state oversight and advocacy to the public defense system, provide resources and training to make sure public defenders have everything they need to defend their clients effectively, and set limits on attorney workloads. But that means offices need more attorneys. McLean County's Public Defense Office has historically kept public defender caseloads within range, but one of the catalysts for passing the measure comes from the 2023 Pretrial Fairness Act, eliminating cash bail in Illinois. This gave accused people the right to a detention hearing, contributing to heavier workloads for both public defenders and prosecutors. McLean County's Public Defense Office has historically kept public defender caseloads within range, but one of the catalysts for passing the measure comes from the 2023 Pretrial Fairness Act, eliminating cash bail in Illinois. This gave accused people the right to a detention hearing, contributing to heavier workloads for both public defenders and prosecutors. In an email, McLean County State's Attorney Erica Reynolds says they average 1 to 2 pretrial detention hearings a day. And the added work created by the Pretrial Fairness Act and the already overtaxed public defenders trickles outward to other areas of the criminal justice system. Again, Champaign County Chief Public Defender Elizabeth Pollack.
Let's face it, this came out of a study done by the Illinois Supreme Court. And when they looked at it, every single stakeholder in the justice system agreed we need to change something.
Pollack says state's attorney, judges, and the Bar Association signed on in support of the legislation.
It is in no one's interest for the public defender to be so under-resourced, to not be able to do their job appropriately, which results in things like ineffective assistance of counsel claims, reversals on appeal, post-conviction petitions. I mean, justice can never be final unless it is fairly litigated in the trial court.
The bill is currently sitting on Governor Pritzker's desk, awaiting final approval. Reporting with Lauren Warnicki, I'm Colleen Holden.
Representatives from the Illinois Arts Council are making stops around Illinois to celebrate the 60th anniversary of the agency. Their itinerary included a visit to Macomb, where Rich Eckert talked to them about their effort.
The Arts Council feels it needs to counter a misperception about its work.
We decided to put more regional focus to our work to try and dispel maybe some of the beliefs that we mostly work in Chicago.
This is Jerome Grand. He's the Arts Council's program director for the western part of the state, which generally includes west central counties between the Illinois and Mississippi rivers.
Coming here to Macomb and seeing the vitality that is in this community and how the arts are part of that vitality is inspiring.
The idea of dividing the state into regions and having a program director for each one of those regions is something new for the state agency. Grand believes the new organizational structure will allow the Arts Council to know communities better and help it better serve people throughout Illinois. Before reorganizing to the regional approach, the Arts Council was structured by discipline. Executive Director Joshua Davis Ruperto says no matter how it's been organized, the IAC has been there for the arts.
We've had 60 years of funding the arts here in Illinois, and we've given out over $500 million to artists and arts organizations that support communities here in Illinois.
Davis Ruperto also says the IAC does more than fund the arts in Chicago. Yes, he says, they do support Chicago-based arts organizations such as the Joffrey Ballet. But he says they also support grandmothers putting on festivals in the basements of churches.
This is for you. You may think that this is for someone in Chicago. You may think that this is for the professional ballet dancer. This is for you. This is your taxpayer dollars. If you have something that you are looking to make happen in your own community, we want to be here to help support that. Never, ever be afraid to reach out to us and have a conversation about what you would love to see in your own community.
Davis Ruperto says in addition to the structural overhaul, the Arts Council has simplified its grant application. He says that's helped increase their grant application pool, with 95% of those applications coming from outside of Chicago. He says the arts provide an economic impact, and he hopes the federal government will continue to support the arts.
We have a long history of supporting the arts through the federal government, and we really hope that that continues for the future.
Davis Ruperto says he feels lucky to live in a state that supports the arts and says that support comes from Republicans and Democrats alike. Christy Steelman is an IAC board member from Bushnell. She agrees that the state supports the arts and hopes Illinois residents will continue to show support.
The arts aren't a luxury. They are in the design of the chairs we sit on, the design of our homes, what we hang on our walls, the music we listen to. There's not one area of our life that is not touched by the arts.
Steelman says you don't need to speak the same language or come from the same background as an artist to be inspired by their work. Steelman says the Arts Council has made some big changes, but she says they're not done.
You tweak as you go, but it's only to make it better and more effective for artists, educators, organizations, even government entities who are doing arts programming.
And she believes it's only going to get even better. Rich Egger reporting.
That's all the time we have for Statewide this week. Thanks for being along with us. Join us next time for more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. Find us where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford, and Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.